You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, episode 27. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today with me is infrastructure engineer at Casa, among other things, Jameson Lopp. Jameson, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So, I kind of want to talk to you. I saw your recent article about your swatting, and I know you've got the project on physical Bitcoin attacks. And so I'd like to kind of talk about that stuff today. But before we get into that, can you kind of share your background of how you got into Bitcoin and maybe what you do or what you did prior to Bitcoin and then kind of what you've done since then?
Sure. I mean, my background before Bitcoin was pretty boring. I was a back-end engineer doing large-scale data analytics for an email marketing company. So basically using a lot of distributed technologies back in the day when cloud was something that most people had never heard of, just to process terabytes and petabytes of information so that people could better target their marketing efforts online to get you the spam emails that you were most likely to click on and buy stuff from. I was never particularly passionate about that as a career. It just happened to provide a lot of interesting computer science problems from a scalability standpoint. And somewhere along the way, I saw a Slashdot article or a Hacker News article or something where it was talking about Bitcoin. And, you know, this was not the first time that I had heard about it. It was just for some reason I realized that this Bitcoin thing was coming back and coming back over and over again, and it was not dying off like I had expected. So that's when I really started looking into it and going down the rabbit hole and just trying to understand how it was working. And that resulted in me forking Bitcoin Core so that I could add a bunch of metrics. And I called that project Statoshi and created operational dashboards, which were basically reminiscent of some of the stuff that I had been doing during my day job. And it just kind of kept going from there. I kept spending more and more time digging into the technicals and doing a couple of open source projects. And then eventually the ecosystem grew large enough that I realized I could probably be getting paid to do this full time. And so I've been a full time wallet engineer for about 3.5 years now.
You were previously at BitGo, but you're currently at Casa. So you want to just kind of give us a brief overview of what Casa does?
Sure. So there's a lot of overlap in similar wallet technologies, I guess, in that BitGo and Casa are both non-custodial multi-sig wallets, meaning that these sets of public-private key pairs are distributed across multiple entities so that you never have a single set of keys or enough sets of keys on a single machine that a hacker could get into and then just, you know, steal all of your crypto assets. So BitGo is very enterprise focused. They're powering a lot of exchanges and other large payment processors, basically working as an automated solution to try to allow these entities to have hot wallets that can do deposits and withdrawals in an automated fashion while still having a better level of security than just having all of your keys on that server. Because after all, I think pretty much everybody is aware of the exchanges that keep getting hacked over and over and over again. They're huge targets because they have so much money. And we did a lot of great work there at BitGo. It wasn't perfect. Sometimes customers still manage to shoot themselves in the foot despite our best efforts. But I think, you know, we did help secure the ecosystem pretty well from a high level. And eventually, though, I felt like the enterprise side of things was coming along very nicely and maturing, but I felt like the personal individual side was still fairly lacking. And so I started working at Casa earlier this year, and Casa is more like a vault product where it's a 3 of 5 multi-sig setup, but this wallet is backed by multiple hardware key management devices like Ledger and Trezor. And the idea being that you as an individual will have multiple hardware devices that you distribute geographically. And this gives you a level of redundancy and security that the vast majority of people in the crypto world don't have, especially if they're trying to, quote unquote, be their own bank. And really what we're just trying to do is make really high security key management attainable for the average individual that isn't a super nerd. And so the whole thing about the, you know, be your own bank in Bitcoin is that it's always been possible to do, but in the early days, it usually required you to use like a lot of command line tools and figure out how to generate private keys manually and print them out on a piece of paper. And just takes a lot of work. Even these days, you know, the best thing that the average person can do is probably buy a Ledger or a Trezor, and that gets you pretty good usability and great security. But we want to take it a step further and also basically help the user with all of the best practices, both like IT practices and general security practices that we're trying to bake into the software so that they can just follow the instructions on the screen and have really good security without having to do a lot of education and like regular maintenance to be sure that their wallet is in a good state.
I think the more that everyone can make things user-friendly, and I don't mean like water things down or dumb them down, but being able to make things simple while still being secure is always a good thing. So, okay, so let's kind of talk about, I don't know what, if you would rather talk about your article and the experience first, or your physical Bitcoin attacks project. I mean, I can only assume that this project on GitHub, this list, comes out of somewhat your personal experience as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's all related. I think that it's really more related to what I've been doing, you know, from the career standpoint. While, you know, the incident with the law enforcement showing up at my house was, it seemed like it was probably related to someone trying to extort me due to the messages I received. That was not really, I think, the primary motivation. I think it was really more just someone trying to screw around with me because I made them mad. But it really did show that there is this physical side of the operational security that you need to be worried about. And it's not just related to like how much money you have, but it can be related to if you're a controversial figure on the internet. And you know, once I started looking into like swattings in general and a lot of the people who have had to go through this, most of the time when it happens, it's just because you made somebody angry and they want to hurt you, but they don't want to put in the time and resources and risk their own life to come and physically attack you. They want to, you know, basically leverage resources of the government to point them at you and target you.
Yeah, and for anybody who's listening who doesn't know what swatting is, basically somebody calls and makes fake threats or whatever as you or some other way gets law enforcement called out to your residence. Is that a good way of summing that up?
Yeah, pretty much. Is that they come up with a reason to make it seem like there's an emergency at your residence. Of course, the tricky thing is first they have to find out where you live, but for a lot of people, that's probably very easy to do. And so that has led me to look more into the privacy side of things as well. And, you know, I'll be releasing more information about, you know, what I've learned from that and how difficult it really is to maintain your privacy in the real world these days.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about, especially since reading your article. It's like, you know, every time you buy something online, maybe with the exception of buying with Bitcoin, right? But if you buy something with physical, I mean, with fiat, especially if you're using some kind of credit card online, then you've got to put, or anything that you have to have shipped to your house, it's, you know, you're putting your physical address in there. And then any of those places that get hacked can list your, you know, someone can get access to your address. I'm sure there's other ways that I haven't even thought of that we're putting our physical address out there as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even clear how many different ways your data can leak. But, you know, you can go to various websites that's all they do is they compile data from as many sources as they can get their hands on. And then you pay them like $50 and you can get a full data dump on basically anybody that you want. And that's just at the, really easy level of like people who know how to use Google. And then if you start extending past that to like darknet stuff, you know, you can find all kinds of data dumps from all kinds of different merchants and other service providers. And so it pretty much comes down to, you know, any data that you put out on the internet, even if it's through like a, you know, encrypted secure connection, that's going into some database somewhere, which in all likelihood over a long enough time frame is eventually going to get leaked out onto the internet.
It's interesting to me. I wouldn't think you're a controversial figure.
Well, at least within the crypto circles, you know, things can get very controversial, especially when you're talking about like the future direction of the protocol. And of course, this is a system where we're talking about the future of money, and there is a lot of money on the line. And you know, a lot of the people who got into it in the early days, and hopefully even today, were very ideologically motivated. And so as a result, they can get very heated when you start talking about, even if you're talking about technical changes, it often comes down to ideals and perspectives that are very deeply rooted in the individual themselves. And so the technical arguments can very easily devolve into ideological arguments. And I think that that's what ends up creating like some of the splits and forks that we've seen happening, is because eventually one group of people gets so frustrated and feels like, you know, the other side isn't compromising with them, then they end up having to use their only other option, which is to basically leave and create their own new system.
I'll have your article in the show notes for everybody listening, and I think you guys should go listen. I mean, go read the article. But walk me through like what goes through your head when you pull up in your neighborhood and, you know, they've got the whole thing blocked off.
Well, I certainly was not thinking, oh, this is related to me. I figured, oh, somebody's in trouble. You know, they've pissed off the police, and now the whole neighborhood is locked down. You know, it probably took like another 10 minutes or so before we finally figured out that, you know, it was me. And that was the point at which I ended up going and talking to them. And then, you know, the very first thing that they asked me was if I had any enemies. And I was like, well, I could probably, you know, think of a few, or at least a few anonymous online people who might want to screw with me like this.
Yeah. You know, and see, this is what's, I guess, scary to me, is that there've been incidents where, let's say the law enforcement in that area is a little more trigger happy, and, you know, people end up hurt or are dead.
Definitely. And that's why it's something where, well, when you look into the laws, there are various states, I think, that have enacted more strict punishment for this type of thing. And it's all on the Wikipedia for swatting, by the way. And I think that, like, California was one of them that did that. And the actual representative or the legislator who, like, proposed the bill that made the punishments more severe, she ended up getting swatted like within a few days. It was kind of weird, but, you know, just looking through all of the different publicly cataloged incidences, it's very interesting how much similarity there is, and how it seems like there's still nothing that law enforcement has really done to try to counter any of this. I guess that it simply hasn't happened at a volume and scale that law enforcement has been forced by, you know, the public to have to deal with it better.
And I'm sure some of that is that it's distributed across the country, right? I mean, like, for there to be any kind of real, like, I'm sure that some place like California or whatever, if they're seeing it enough, then they're going to do something about it. But if it's not taking place enough in your municipality or your state, then they're not going to do it. And so as these things are more spread up, you know, spread out across the country, we see it by nature of social media or whatever. And so we might get a conglomerate of it across the nation, but, you know, our local law enforcement or whatever doesn't see it enough to really do something about it. And the other side is it's difficult to trace back, you know, the person who initiates this, isn't it?
If they did it correctly, yes. I mean, sometimes it is just like a stupid kid who doesn't have any sophistication, whatever, and they actually use their real phone, and of course they get caught very quickly. But I suspect, you know, there are some people out there who know how to hide their tracks, and they probably do this on a regular basis whenever somebody angers them. And I think that people haven't quite extrapolated how this might evolve in the future. And I think I had a tweet where I was basically saying that it's not hard to imagine in the near future, just with a few more tools, and we're already getting there, where you can, you know, simulate a very believable human voice artificial intelligence that's at least smart enough to pass the Turing test for, you know, maybe a minute or two, especially if it's a highly specialized thing. And I could very easily imagine people just spooling up thousands of instances of specially engineered, very narrow artificial intelligence bots that are designed for, you know, swatting type attacks, and they're just calling up all of the emergency centers all over the country or all over the world and basically creating a denial of service attack that costs very, very little from an engineering standpoint, and yet they'd be able to pull it off with very low risk of actually getting caught themselves.
Yeah, it's very asymmetric, because then the what it costs to deal with it is much, much more for all these different cities and states and whatever.
So maybe once that happens, law enforcement will actually make some changes, because they'll be forced to deal with it. They simply won't be able to ignore it at that point.
Yeah. Does that say something more about just the nature of how fast a big response, like a SWAT team or something, comes out?
I guess you mean in terms of how quickly those resources get deployed by the local law enforcement?
Yeah, and how fast they escalate. I mean, thank God yours didn't end in anybody getting hurt or killed, but I mean, I've read of other things that did, and it's like, you know, they were very quick to fire, and it seems like there's not much repercussions on either individual officers or the agencies that employ them when things go south, and it was all, you know, nobody was actually committing a crime.
Right. Because, you know, law enforcement officers have this degree of protection from the state. Like, the state wants to protect its agents that are doing the will of the state. And so even when there is, injury or even death caused by an agent of the state, if there is even a slight degree of, like, you know, plausibility that that agent had a right to believe that they were in danger, and, you know, in a case like this, it can be simply that, you know, they received a call that made them believe there was a very high risk threat in the area, that, you know, the agent was basically doing what they had been trained to do. And so, you know, it really requires a very outlandish degree of gross negligence in order for agents of the state usually to end up with penalties, because they have such a shield of protection around them. You know, in a lot of cases, even if they did obviously make a very wrong decision at the time, what you see with a lot of these officers is that they will get basically, you know, discharged from their local agency, but just get picked up by some other agency in the nearby vicinity within a pretty short time frame. And that, you know, there are some folks like this who basically repeat offenders and just hop around throughout their entire career, possibly until they do something so bad that they actually end up in prison.
I'm just trying to think, like, what can you do specifically to this? Like, what can you do to kind of protect yourself from such a scenario? And I don't know.
I mean, unfortunately, it really requires starting your life over. The vast majority of people, at least in the United States, because that's what I'm familiar with, are already in so many databases that if someone wants to find you, especially if it's someone who knows how to search through information online, then they will probably be able to find your physical address. And once that's done, it's not hard to find the like non-emergency phone number to your local law enforcement and then make a call that gets escalated to the emergency department. And so really the only defense is a level of protection on your privacy that takes a lot of effort, a lot of time and money. And I've spent quite a bit of time and money this year figuring out how to do that. And I'll be giving a presentation at the, let's see, what's the conference in Latvia, the Baltic Honey Badger Conference.
Oh,
in
okay,
a few
cool.
Months.
Will that be streamed or recorded or something for those of us who can't make it?
Yeah, I'm sure it will be recorded, and then I'm also I'll have a very, very long detailed blog post that's currently at like 5,000 words of like every single possible like data leak that you would have to worry about if you want to be extremely paranoid about your operational security and your privacy.
Awesome. Very cool. Okay, well then let's kind of transition then into just general, like what are some basic, whether digital or physical, like OPSEC things that most people just don't do or would be a good basis to start on?
Yeah, so while I was doing all of this research and setting up all these new like privacy protections for various aspects of my life, I noticed a few different patterns that were coming up. One pattern is the proxy pattern, where basically instead of doing something yourself, you have a proxy, you know, a third party who's actually undertaking those actions. And so if you're technical, you're probably thinking of a network proxy right now. And most technical people are familiar with things like VPNs, virtual private networks, or Tor, which is the onion routing network. And those are things that give you additional privacy while you're browsing on the internet, because basically you're routing all of your traffic through some other server so that the end server that you're talking to, whatever website or other service, does not see your real IP address. They only see the IP address of whatever you're being routing your traffic through. And that type of strategy is actually applicable to a number of things in life. And so I have ended up using proxies for a lot of other things that I've been doing, like anything that is creating a public record, basically. So, for example, in America, at least, you have something called real property, which is things like houses and automobiles. These are things that you have to pay property tax on, and they're registered with different government entities. And so I use proxies now for my ownership of real property. None of my property is owned by me in my name, but rather by other entities that I've set up that can't be tracked to me, that don't have my name on them. And then also, I've been using proxies like lawyers to interact with other third parties that are, you know, providing services for me, so that, you know, if I have a service provider, I'm not directly interacting with them. They don't know that they're providing a service for me. They only know that they're interacting with my attorney or some other proxy, for example. And you know, there's countless other examples that I'll go into more detail. But then another strategy is the like hide in the crowd strategy. The you know, don't do anything out of the ordinary. Make yourself blend in. And so you know, one example of that is, you know, if you're walking around or driving around, you're not going to find me unless I'm at a conference or some special event. I'm not going to be wearing like crypto branded clothing. I don't want to have like a Bitcoin bumper sticker or license plate on my car anymore, which, by the way, I did for about 5 years. I had the Bitcoin license plate. and so I was doing that from a marketing perspective. It was obviously bad operational security, but it was a trade-off that I was making. And it started a lot of interesting conversations. And so that's just like something to think about, like as the environment continues to change. And this is one of the reasons I started, you know, cataloging those physical Bitcoin attacks, is because I felt like we were getting to the point where your more ordinary criminals were starting to understand that crypto owners might be very juicy targets, because they're in some cases they can basically be like banks that are walking around, but they don't have bank level security.
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing, and I did kind of want to get your perspective on this, but like, because I've heard some people talk about like, oh, it's not something we should be ashamed of putting, you know, wearing Bitcoin shirts or hats or whatever, because, you know, if enough people do it, then we normalize it and it doesn't mean anything, in the same way that, you know, if somebody walks around with a shirt with the dollar sign on it, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a lot of money. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, and hopefully we do get to that point someday, but right now we're in a much riskier early adopter phase. And it's kind of like you said, like once it becomes normal, then like people aren't going to be walking around with it, emblazoned logos, unless, and, you know, unless they're part of a subculture that glorifies money, I guess.
Sure.
But it's you know, if crypto does get to the point that it's mainstream, you know, that is probably when it's going to be boring. And just like now, like up before crypto, like the only people who really talked about money were usually like economists or potentially like financial instrument traders, you know, just general like finance types. But like pretty much everybody else in the world would never talk about, hey, let's talk about the dollar or the yen or the peso or whatever. It's like, it's not that interesting. It's just a tool and you use it and you go about your lives. And, you know, hopefully Bitcoin will get to that point eventually.
Yeah. So you don't wear your UASF hat when you go out to the store, I guess.
Well, that one you can get away with because most people just think you're like dyslexic and that it's an Air Force hat.
Yeah. Do you ever get thanked for your service?
I definitely had a number of people ask me if I wanted the military discount.
Oh man, that's funny. Okay, so you mentioned your physical Bitcoin attacks project. Now, how many? Okay, so briefly, for those who haven't seen it, you've got a kind of a chronological list with links to articles about known physical attacks on people for the purpose of stealing Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. And when did you start this?
I think it was just a few months ago. Yeah, it was like late spring of 2018.
Gotcha. So, and how many, let me see, I had it pulled up a minute ago. How many cases do you have on there right now?
Last I checked, I thought it was approaching 40. It was like 30 to 40 now. Like one of the reasons that I sat down and actually started cataloging it was because I had been saying for a while that I felt like the number of physical incidents in this space was accelerating, but of course having a feeling isn't really good enough, so I wanted to actually get some hard metrics on it. I will say it seems like they've died off over the past month or two. At least I haven't heard of anything. Of course, that doesn't mean that they're stopping or slowing down. Some of these things we don't hear about until a lot later. And also, I think that the ones that I've cataloged are, you know, probably just a small minority of the ones that have actually happened. Like, these are the ones that received news coverage or got some sort of publicity. But, you know, I am aware of, you know, through the grapevine, a number of other incidents where people just haven't publicized it, usually because they're too embarrassed to talk about it or because they don't want to make themselves even bigger targets. And so I think especially if you start looking at the local Bitcoin's forums, for example, there are a lot of physical robberies that happen using these various face-to-face, peer-to-peer trading platforms. And that's because it's a way for you to anonymously meet with someone who's going to be bringing a lot of money with them. And so, you know, it's a very easy way to find new targets. And I think there's a lot of robbery stories that are posted on there that I simply could not verify. And so, you know, did not add to my list. But I suspect that there's probably quite a few more that have happened out there that no one has even spoken about.
Yeah. So, and I haven't used local Bitcoins myself, mostly because I don't live in a big city where there's really much of an option there. So, I don't know, maybe you've used local Bitcoins, like, and if you have, like, what do you think, what are good things to do if you're going to, I guess on either side of the sale, whether you're the one bringing cash to buy Bitcoin or you're the one selling Bitcoin for large sums of cash, like, what are things you can do to help protect yourself?
Yeah, I've actually never done like face-to-face transaction. I never really had the need to. But you should just follow like some general safety guidelines. And in fact, like a lot of law enforcement departments, they post information, though generally they're going to say, you know, if you're doing a Craigslist transaction or whatever, but the same concepts generally apply. And so one thing, for example, is you could actually check to see if your local police department has a quote unquote like a safe purchase zone, where I've seen, especially in the bigger cities, the headquarters of the police department will have like a place where you can go meet up with someone and do your transaction right there, you know, at the headquarters of the police department. Or, you know, you could potentially do it in a bank or some other place that's public that has, you know, surveillance cameras, you know, so that you may not be able to stop someone from robbing you, but you would at least have enough information to help investigators try to track them down after the fact. You know, and then finally, of course, you know, if it's applicable to you, you should probably know how to defend yourself, be able to defend yourself if something goes sideways. But that gets into, you know, more philosophical quandaries where some people don't want to go down that path.
Oh, you mean like carrying or knowing martial arts or something like that?
Absolutely. And of course, it gets really interesting when you, if you start looking at how over-the-counter trades happen sometimes, where I've heard some stories of, you know, trying to do a $100 million Bitcoin trade. Like, how do you do a trade for that much money with someone that you don't know and don't trust? And I've seen some very complicated protocols get set up where, you know, you have, you know, like 10 different people involved and you're like renting out hotel rooms and you're doing these swaps of like briefcases of money, like, you know, a little bit at a time. I think the average person won't have to deal with that, but, you know, it kind of does come up with deciding upon a certain protocol of how to interact with each other.
Yeah. I think you had tweeted out at one point and had your training mannequin posted for your what do you Krav Maga or something like that.
That's right.
So you're prepared, clearly.
I try to be.
Yeah. So, and I guess this kind of depends on where you live too, and what the local laws are as far as concealed carry or something along those lines. I live in Texas, so they're pretty.
You're set.
Yeah. So, and kind of that's nice in the sense that, like, everybody just, if you're intelligent, you should assume that anybody could be carrying. But kind of going back to the signaling and just, trying to be the gray man and not stand out in a crowd. I had talked to Ansel Linder about this one time, but we were talking about, being, and you've run into this, like being, I guess, having your name out there at some point kind of also puts a certain risk on your family as well. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a paradox where as soon as you start talking publicly about crypto, then you kind of become a target. And of course, if you've been talking about crypto for quite a few years, then the immediate assumption that potential attackers are going to have are that, oh, you bought a ton of it right when you started talking about it, and you never sold any of it, and so you've probably got millions and millions of dollars and you're a juicy target. So I think the smartest people are the ones that have remained anonymous. I interact with pseudonyms on a daily basis, and I would say there's a number of pseudonyms who I trust more than a lot of people who I know they're like real registered government identity. It's kind of interesting how that works out. And I've even gotten to meet a number of them face to face. And I actually know what some of them look like, but I still don't know who they are, but it doesn't matter. If you're going to be more public, and especially if you're going to be more like outspoken and controversial, then you do have to think about potential ripple effects of how your own actions might result in more stress on your family.
This kind of brings it full circle, but I guess the other thing is making it difficult. God forbid you should be in a situation where somebody has a physical advantage over you and wants your wants to get your Bitcoin or your crypto or whatever. You kind of talked at the beginning about what you guys are working on at Casa. And so what are some things you can do should you find yourself in that situation? What are things you can do ahead of time to prepare to make it more difficult in that situation for someone to be able to get your crypto?
Right. I mean, ultimately, you have to set up your vault per se so that you don't have direct access to it very easily. That's the only way to prevent an attacker from using the $5 wrench attack or rubber hose attack or whatever you want to call it on you, is that if you can't physically comply with that. And of course, there's no perfect answer to this. You start going down a lot of different like logical forks of how situations like that might play out with, the attacker is not going to be happy if you say, I have nothing for you, so maybe you should have a small kind of token wallet to give them a little bit of a bribe to make them go away. And there's no guarantees. I mean, obviously, what you want to do is prevent yourself from ever getting into that situation in the first place. So then, starting to talk about decoy wallets or whatever, I don't have a lot of faith in those because I've never been in that type of like life or death situation, but I suspect that it would be very difficult for you to like remember other pins or other passwords or whatever to like open up decoy wallets and appease your attacker. So I think it's just a lot simpler to say, okay, we're gonna set up the wallet in a way that you don't have enough key material to access it without jumping through a lot of hoops and, you know, traveling around geographically and going into multiple access controlled locations.
Yeah, so the thing with Decoy wallets, also kind of going back to what we talked about being a public figure, you know, with that same assumption that you talked about earlier that they might have made, that like, oh, you're a public figure and you've been in this for a while, so I'm assuming you have, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in crypto. I just don't see somebody buying that, like, oh, well, you've only got $100 or $200 in this, you know, other wallet that you're giving me. So I think maybe for like a random mugger, maybe they, you know, and I guess that goes back to like, you know, if you're wearing a shirt that says Bitcoin on it and a random mugger comes up, then they might be fooled. But an informed attacker, I don't see being fooled by that.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though, is that, you know, in most cases, we have no idea how much money other people in the space have, but I'm aware of a few very well-known folks in the space who have been in it a lot longer than I have, who have very little crypto because they basically were living on it. And so, you know, they had to liquidate a lot of what they got over the years. And I guess the most famous example of that was Andreas Antonopoulos, where someone, I guess, it was like Roger Ver.
It was Roger,
Yeah, I was accusing him of like not investing enough in Bitcoin early on, and fortunately/unfortunately for Andreas, he ended up getting gifted like $1 million worth of Bitcoin. So now I guess he really is more of a target. So that's kind of a weird gift. Now he has to deal with the, you know, repercussions of everybody knowing that.
Sure. Although I guess depending, when was that? That was like November or something like that. So it's, it may have gone down some since then. So, yeah. So should all of us podcasters like go back and start our life over, you know, secret life, and just delete everything that we've done up till now?
It's another one of those paradoxes, I guess, of like, it's not worth doing until you have so much attention that people are going to try to attack you. But how do you know that you have generated enough attention that people are going to attack you until it actually happens? And so, like, I've had people ask me things like, well, have you considered hiring, you know, bodyguards to protect you? And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, I've considered it, but I really don't think I'm at that level. I know a number of people who are. But I think that, you know, just putting in the time and effort to improve my privacy should be sufficient. Whereas, you know, there are some people in the space who are very, very outspoken, almost like braggart style billionaires who, you know, go out of their way to get a lot of publicity about, you know, making very expensive purchases and, you know, living flamboyant lifestyles. And so I would expect that those people would be more likely to get, you know, physically attacked than I would be. But you just never know.
Yeah. I think if you're, I think you could probably afford security if you're going full billionaire mode, if that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, well, you know, folks who like to buy yachts and basically entire tops of buildings that they then get press releases basically saying that, oh, I just bought this huge amount of real estate. It's just a very different way of going about things. And actually, if you're familiar with, I think it was Forbes, where they had a like top 10 or top something crypto wealthy list that came out last year.
Oh, really?
The people who were on that, they had to agree to have their name listed on there, because I know several people who said no, like, do not put my name on that list. But the people who are on there were contacted and gave permission, and in some cases, like, gave headshots and bios and all kinds of other stuff. And I think I had a kind of pithy tweet about that where I was like, you know, some people see this as like a list of very successful people, and I was like, well, I just see a list of targets. You know, they've just made themselves targets. It's kind of weird and antithetical to what I've been doing.
Okay, well, let's kind of transition from that into your other projects real quick before we wrap up. But you've got a ton of resources at lop.net. And I know, like, when I first got into Bitcoin, Ansel Lenders from Bitcoin and Market, his resources was what I kind of went through. And I know that he said that his were based on yours. And then I went back to yours and read through it. So if anybody hasn't been there, they should check your resources out. And personally, thank you for that list, because it's good stuff to go through.
Yeah, that's probably what most people who come up to me are thanking me for. And it was really a very self-serving thing. It was, you know, I was getting tired of having to go back and find resources to answer these really common questions that I got from people. And so over time, I eventually just started compiling the links that I was handing out the most often to the most common questions. And that turned into a different web page. And then I redesigned my whole website to make it look nicer. And as of today, it's pretty active and actually gets contributions on a regular basis. I'm probably updating it at least like once or twice a week, either with stuff that I have found or with other material that has been contributed by people.
Cool. And then you also have Statoshi, which you kind of mentioned earlier. And that's like statistics on the network itself, correct?
Yeah, so it's basically a Bitcoin core node that I have added about 500 lines of instrumentation code to. So it's just emitting a lot of metrics whenever any sort of interesting event happens. And then those metrics are all getting aggregated by other software. And then I've got this nice iCandy dashboard called Grafana that is taking those databases of metrics and spitting out very pretty graphs that basically show you like what has been going on. Some of it, you know, is like network-wide metrics, and then some of it is very specific to my node itself, but should be generally applicable to most other full nodes on the network. And that's really, like I said, that was my first project where I felt like one of the great aspects of Bitcoin was just how open and transparent it was. However, I felt like what the internal operations of what the nodes themselves were doing was very opaque. And so my whole goal was to add a new level of transparency to running a Bitcoin node. And I was approaching it from this DevOps perspective of like what I had been doing at my day job. And I just wanted to make it easier for the Bitcoin developers themselves to make educated decisions about things that might need to be changed to make the nodes even better. And I think that I succeeded there. There were a number of developers who have included graphs from Satoshi over the years to make arguments about different changes to Bitcoin.
Oh, nice. It's always nice to see your work be used by other people. Yeah, so it seems like both of those kind of came out of this scratch your own itch kind of mentality.
Yeah, and then also I have this Bitcoin Core config generator, which was also fairly self-serving because I run a lot of nodes, and also I get a lot of questions about, you know, how should I configure my node if I want to do X, Y, or Z? And last I checked, there's something like 150 or maybe even 170 configuration options in Bitcoin Core, which is, of course, an insanely high amount to have to dig through all the documentation for. And so I ripped that off of a Parity project. So the Parity node implementation for Ethereum, they had created this very nice WYSIWYG graphical config generator. And I basically forked that and changed it and tweaked all of the options and, you know, added in all of the Bitcoin config stuff, and seems to be working pretty well.
Awesome. I'm going to have to check that out. I didn't realize that. I assume you took out the part where you can send contracts into the void.
Oh, yeah. It's it took me a few days to basically rip out all of the Ethereum specific stuff. But, you know, the general gist of it was the same of, you know, you're going to have a form and it's going to spit out a bunch of text that is your config file. So all I had to do was like change the actual options and values and descriptions and then the final like format of the file itself.
Very cool. Like I said, I'm going to have to check that out. I didn't realize you had that. So yeah, it is kind of a pain to, when you want to change something on your configuration, if you're not a day-to-day coder, which I'm not, to go in and, okay, what is this option? Okay, what are the argument? Or, you know, what's the string that I've got to put in here and then reboot everything? So yeah, that's nice. I'm going to go do that for myself here. Okay, well, where can people keep up with you?
I pretty much live on Twitter, though, you know, these days a lot of us are also testing out Mastodon. But yeah. I'm on Twitter. My handle is just LOPP, LOPP. And I'm also on the Mastodon.social instance with the same handle. However, whoever got my handle on the Bitcoin Hackers instance is not me. So I don't know if they're planning on doing some scamming there or if they're just squatting on it and hoping that I'll have to buy it from them.
Oh, good to know. Good to also put out there for everyone to know that that's not him. So, okay. So, and I'll put links to both of those as well as all your stuff on GitHub and LOPP.net and Satoshi and all that on the show notes. Bottomshelfbitcoin.com/27 is where the show notes will be, everybody. And Jameson, anything else you wanted to go over or put out there for anybody before we say goodbye?
Well, I usually just close by saying, you know, I'm not an expert, and I don't think that anybody is an expert at this. We're all just kind of stumbling along head first into this crazy new world that we're trying to build. And, you know, I'm just trying to help other people understand as much as I have been able to ingest. But a lot of other people out there understand things in this ecosystem that I don't. And, you know, we're all just building off of each other's work and trying to collaborate. And that's what it's really all about, is trying to come to a consensus about like the best way to reshape the financial world.
Awesome. Well said. All right. It was a pleasure having you on. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime.
All right. That's going to do it for this show. Remember, all the show notes will be at bottomshelfbitcoin.com/27. You guys go check out all that stuff from Jameson Lopp. And I totally forgot. My brain was fried during this interview, not because of anything I intentionally did to my body. I just was sleep deprived at that point. So big thanks to Jameson Lopp for putting up with me during that process. So anyways, but I totally forgot to ask him about the Casa does certified sales of both Ledger and Trezor hardware wallets. So you guys check out their store there as well as their multi-sig security setup thing. Anyways, you listened to the episode. He explained it better than I did. So go check out their stuff. Go check out his physical Bitcoin attacks project as well as his quick Bitcoin configuration generator and all the other stuff. Like I said, listed in the show notes. And you guys know you can support the show here at patreon.com/bottomshelfbitcoin, or you can buy Tuttle Twins books, bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook, or I've got Bitcoin donation at bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate. You can check out all those links and share the show, give us a good review, check me out on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and the Bitcoin Hackers instance of Mastodon at Bottom Shelf BTC. All right, for Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening. I'm still recovering. Friday night, we had a youth event at our church and literally stayed up all night.
Well, get some rest.
Yeah, I need to.